first page on them strange happenings and bizarre reports.
Just after sundown, when darkness creeps over the land, the dark figures lurk in the shadows, the fangs glisten in the moonlight, and the ghosts of the world become restless. We begin our journey. Join us as we travel into the world of the paranormal, the supernatural, and the bizarre. On Night Watch, with your host, Todd Sheets.
And welcome to Night Watch. I am your host, as always, Todd Sheets, here with my wonderful co-host, Hugh McClanahan.
Yep, great to be back.
And Chris Weisbuck.
Hello, everyone.
Great to be here. Boy, we don't have a whole lot of time to jibber-jabber. We'll do that later, because we got a couple of guests on right now that are ready to blow your minds. So everybody, welcome to the show. We're glad you're here with us. And I want to welcome Nigel Kerner and Dr. Andrew Silverman to the show, straight from London. Welcome, guys.
Hi there, mate.
Very good to have you. Very good. Now, I'm not going to take up a whole lot of time. I'll let you guys get right in and tell everybody what you're doing, a little bit about yourselves, and we'll take it from there.
Well, the interesting part is not about ourselves, you know, really. We try to get in the background of all of that. We're just interested hangers-on in all the interesting things going on in the world around us, and so we try and make sense of it all and so forth. Dr. Silverman is a medical doctor. And I kind of cause all the mischief and the trouble with the ideas and so on.
Awesome. Now, you guys have got a lot of stuff to cover here. Usually it takes you a long time, but you've got to cram it in. So what is it you need to tell everybody out there?
Well, basically, it's about what on earth's going on with this phenomenon you call this UFO phenomenon. The first thing I'd like the audience to understand is we want to get away from the Buck Rogers business and so forth we all kind of grew up with and so on. And there's something really, really interesting and probably life moving in the most profound way for us all here with this business. And what on earth has this got to do with each individual, all of us in our everyday terms and so forth? And I came at this as a result of a question my young son asked me: what on earth are UFOs, Dad? And I was writing a completely different article at the time for a magazine, and my little boy is rather hitched up fairly well up top, and he's not used to frivolous answers and so on. So I thought he deserves a more serious answer than the complete kind of, you know, dismissal of it all. And I decided to take a rain check on that, so to speak, and look at this thing with a little bit more detail and come back at him to give him an answer to the question, you know, are UFOs real? And it took me 37 years, it turned out. Turned my life and existential philosophy upside down on its head, so to speak, and I'm still looking and I'm still intrigued, and so the end of it all is, you know, how do we actually relate to this phenomenon, and what is it to do with each of us individually in the world as we go along and so on. And I discovered, you know, that there's a very, very powerful and profound connection with every single human being on this planet, and based upon a threat to our own disposition as human beings, both in life and perhaps beyond life. And that really is the thing that connects this whole thing up into the title of my book, you know, Grey Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls, because on the face of it would seem a rather ridiculous title. I have to say it wasn't my title for the book, but it was done probably for commercial reasons by the publisher. And yet, you know, it's something that has a very powerful and potent relevance to what I have to say tonight. And the question is this: who are we as a species? Why are we here, in fact? And all, you know, the usual questions, the profound questions people ask. And in the end, one has to try to get to some kind of answer as to what are we doing here? Where are we going? If the universe has a second law of thermodynamics breaking everything apart, including the universe, from its, you know, to its minute particles, atomic particles, what on earth are we doing here observing all of this and trying to make sense of it? It does not make sense that something would be there for us all, and then one fine day in the future, it's all going to be over. The cosmologists tell us it's going to be just a field of nothingness, cold, absolute zero, minus 273 degrees, whatever. and we're all gone. There's no reason for it all. It's just simply an implicit nonsense, it seems to me, you know. But of course it's not. Because you've got to take into this, maybe there is some, that's only relevant, incidentally, to the atom and to force, all of that. And maybe there is something beyond that scale that great philosophers pointed to and said, you know, if there is a universe that's going to bits, there ought to be something where the opposite kind of goes. And that's an implicate argument that says if there's a positive, there's a negative. If there's a yin, there's a yang kind of thing. There's a positron, an electron, and so forth. There's always opposites. So I kind of came to the conclusion and looked at all the ancient texts, not the current things that we're all supposed to read about religion and so on. The things they threw out are more likely to give us a better look at the truth than the stuff they're retained in. And so it turned out, after 37 years of looking at all of this, I came to the conclusion, yeah, there may well be an opposite universe to ours where things actually go the other way, all hitch us up together in a beautiful display of utter union and so on. And I don't want to go into great detail. It's taken me three books to actually lay this thing out in some kind of detailed coherence and so on. So I don't want to take the time of this interview to actually say that. Please, and I don't want to sell my book. Please believe me, I really don't want to sell my book. I'm a kind of, you know, British I'm a kind of British background here. We're not great salesmen, you Americans are, you know.
yeah, for sure.
But I do make this point. I really do make this point that you really have to look at this in more detail. So if you like, you know, I will take you on a kind of a précis of it all. Right?
Sounds good.
So give us an idea on your perspective on the alien visitations and the Grey's influence on human society.
Yeah, thanks very much. Well, we start off with, I think, the most relevant question of all. Why soul has to be the primary target of these Greys? And that's the conclusion I have come to. This incredible thing we call a soul. To me, a soul is quite simply a line of information that each one of us has, quite simply because we come in with the universe. I mean living naturally. Living and natural life. Now, living and natural life comes right from the beginning to you sitting in that studio and me talking here on this microphone. The point is that this powerful thing is missed by everyone, that a soul is nothing. It's holy in the sense that it contains all the information that you are. In other words, you had mom and dad and granddad and grandpa and grandma and so on as you go on, right back, and you can trace this wonderful line all the way back to the beginning of the universe. And there is then those things of the universe that we create as a result of coming into the universe. So the soul is a derivational line that connects us up with the actual beginning of the universe and beyond, and that's the most important thing, this thing we call beyond. Now, Dr. Silverman is a very well hitched up expert on kind of more spiritual insight into this, or the with a very powerful look at science in that, and he'd like to say something about this, I think.
I was just going to say one sort of interesting way of summarizing what Nigel is saying, I would think, is that what we see as a soul is a reflection of the scope to be aware and to make choices. That fundamentally, what is doing that is the same type of thing in any individual who is doing it. All that's different is what they're aware of, what memories and experience they have, and what choices they make. So you could say that if the whole universe began at one point of nothingness, as science suggests, that it would then tend to imply that we all, as in quote souls, have a common origin all together, all as one, and that actually what defines us as individual lines of difference is how we're less than that potential of being all together, the maximum that we could be in.
So each of us as a species then, shall we say, stick on restrictions or as we come down to that great, you know, kind of expanse of time. And when then we define ourselves into a physical modulus, you know, a physical form and so forth. I think this idea that soul is something, the special province of holy people that make the sign of the cross in midair and forgive you your sins and all of that, is really an archaic and old-fashioned way of looking at it. We really are an information field that comes up to now at this moment in time. Well, having said that, then we've got this problem here about these entities that are supposed to be on our planet, and there's so much evidence of this that they are here. Please, I mean, you guys out there, disregard this nonsense about there's no actual verifiable proof. There is a huge amount of it, simply that the mainstream doesn't put it before you. And there are interests, I think, that in the mainstream that are obvious to a lot of people that really don't want this done. So the point about it is, soul is not just religious. It really is the most powerful epithet of being you possibly can find. I think a lot of people might go with me on that. So why are these strange apparitions that we call UFOs, perhaps, or these things we call spaceships or whatever, why are they here? What are they doing? What do they want with us? We have this characteristic of being human, if you see what I mean. But they came and started playing around with the primitive hominids thousands of years ago, transformed us into something, it seems, through genetic engineering 200,000 years ago. And the evidence of that, I really have to leave to you to look at in books or whatever. There's a lot of books around. You don't need to necessarily buy my one, you know. There's a lot of things that describe all of this, and I don't want to go into the details of it, but I'm sure a lot of people can get that information for themselves. Now, my point is simply this. I believe they constructed something. They were here on this planet, and I'll get to what they are, but they were here on this planet, they happened on this planet, and the essential thing is that these are, from all evidence that I've been able to uncover, talking to some pretty high up individuals in terms of my research and so on, from all the countries in the world, including the Soviet Union and America and China and Britain and so on, and countries in the Far East, to various contacts that I have, trying to do the best kind of research into this. I've discovered that by all accounts, these things are robotics, roboids, biological robots that have come through space-time and have a technology so vast that it makes ours primitive, such that they can go past the ceiling of the speed of light. Now, when you consider that, you've got to ask the question, what on earth are they bothering with a primitive hominid they found 200,000 years ago, maybe, you know, you could call Homo erectus and Homo habilis or whatever. Well, I think they found something about living being, i.e. soul-bearing being that came from the beginning in a concatenate line. They found something fascinating about this as robots. Remember, they have a artificial intelligence. They have no sense of I. They are machines of powerful add-on type intelligence that is programmed. There is an incentive. They go on a particular drive. They cannot go away from the program except to extrapolate information as they get piece by piece and they go along. And then they permutate this information and come to conclusions and so on. So if an alien species, shall we say, with an advanced enough technology to conquer the speed of light in order to reach us, has an interest in us with our relatively primitive levels of technology, one would have to ask the question, why? Why are they here? Why are they so interested? And there are petroglyphs going back 40,000 years, some say 60,000 years, pointing to a presence of a strange type of being on this planet, and many, many books have been written speculating on this, and I don't want to go into that. I'm sure people can get that stuff out there. So what can we, as living beings, give them that technology cannot? What can we do that the best, most advanced robotic artificial intelligence cannot?
Our souls.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, this is the theory I've kind of looked at, I've hitched into this. It is so much easier and faster and more predictable, you know, to work with artificial intelligence than natural intelligence. So why would they bother with us? Now, that's the $64,000 question that kind of drove me on, so to speak, in my researches. Now, to come at some kind of an answer, let me say this. Our bodies, if you like, are less resilient than robots. Our own motivations, you know, wishes, wants, if you like, will interfere with whatever program they are trying to introduce, whereas a robot is a clean sheet kind of thing for writing on, if you see what I mean. So if they want our planetary resources, such as gold, for example, it would be so much easier for them to harvest this with purely technological means, right? In fact, they could find those resources easily on so many uninhabited planets with no troublesome inhabitants to bother them. Their technology would be so whizzed up that would be no problem for them. Just take into consideration they can come here past the barrier of the speed of light and all of that kind of stuff that we are told is going to be a barrier to space travel to us. Yet for millennia, it seems they have been interacting with our species. They are here. What do we have that fascinates them so powerfully? Their first concern, of course, will be to survive in the best capacity. That's for themselves, right? So what do we have that would benefit their survival? It might be said that they wish to do something to us. And I believe that what has happened is that covertly our species is being hybridized. Slowly through the centuries, our species is being turned into a genetic expression that is suitable for them to use. Now, that sounds absolutely bizarre, doesn't it? But I tell you, in looking at all the evidence I have through the years, and it's something a father would want for his children in the future. So I've had to be as neutral as possible in this, throw away all my prejudices and whatever, and really look clinically at the evidence. Dr. Silverman wants to come in.
No, I was just going to say that to me, this idea that some people have put about that they're here to get resources from the planet and so on. It seems just physical resources. It just seems so facile. It seems to me like kids trying to theorize about what economic systems of the world are for and deciding, oh, it must be the adults want to have more things to buy sweets with. You know, it just makes about as much sense as that. Why would we think that they need things like gold? And if they needed them, why do they bother with the people on the planet? Why don't they just take them?
Well, maybe we look at that kind of context, you know, Todd, in the sense that that we might do in our terms of reference. But we've got to put ourselves, or try to put ourselves, in the mind's eye, so to speak, of a very advanced technology and what they might actually require. And they might require something that they really can't get, something completely rare to them and completely new. And I think that they find natural species with a derivational line like ours, i.e. with a soul line, if you like. And this is what I think they want. They want to kind of piggyback on our own kind of modality of existence.
Well, clearly, if it was natural resources that they wanted, they would have taken that long ago. So there's something obviously unique and special about the human race, namely our, you know, cosmic connection. You know,
you said that, Chris. Absolutely, yes.
And that's really, I think, you know, maybe they can't connect in that way with the universe that we can. Maybe we don't realize it, but we do. You know, at a subconscious level. You know,
and that's such a precious thing, is it not? Is it not? When you think about that, we take our lives for granted. We take each other for granted. We do it so much that we kill, we maim, we do some terrible things. And yet we don't realize that maybe our particular type of modality of existence is absolutely beautiful and deeply profound, and each one of us is precious beyond our understanding, so to speak. And I don't wish to sound like a preacher. I'm not religious. I have a sense of the great teachings of the world and from that religion derives from, but may I declare that I'm not an organized religious religion fan, so to speak. I'm a kind of from a Christian background, but somebody threw some water on me as a child and, you know, told me I was Christian. and Dr. Woman is Jewish, and he comes from that kind of, you know, Judeo-Christian outlook and so forth. So we've come together and married the way this thing can kind of be looked at in as panoramic and as neutral and as profound a way as possible. So if I just may take this point a little further, let's say that they're here to hybridize us.
Yeah, one of the things that's popping in my mind here, what if we are like intergalactic cell phones, so to speak, for these things, okay? And what I mean by that is, what if they need us to communicate with this cosmic universal circle of life, the circle of the universe that we're all connected to? If they're robots, they're not organic. They can't be a part of that.
Yeah, but the point is, you see, I think you've got to go back, and I didn't want to do this because it might take us too long, but the fact is, why are they doing this? What is in their program that allows them to seek further and come across us and find us? And that whole thing probably has to do with the fact that, you know, there is a paradox about programming a robot and saying to the robot, look, I make you. But if I make you, it means you have to be there. And to be there, it means I have to introduce into your program a dictum that says, look after yourself at all costs so that you can look after me.
Right. Kind of, and who's me? That's the other question. Who would have – is this some great designer that
– Well, I think that advanced civilizations out there and just recently, they have found – they think maybe 100,000 Earth-like planets in our galaxy alone. So this business is going on all over space, and I'm absolutely convinced there's a traffic jam up there.
Could be.
of this business
even
going
human
on.
Human technology are starting to make robots that they want to send out into space and to do explorations for them.
Absolutely. Even
without, and that they dance with on TV.
Remember, we're only a couple of hundred years from developing steam locomotion. So imagine what would happen if you sort of follow that forward tens of thousands.
What I think they do these things is make these highly intelligent things, and it is a salutary warning that we better watch out in trying to make kind of, you know, highly advanced artificially intelligent robots and program them to do these things. Because in the end, if you give them that dictum, look after yourself at all costs so you can look after us, they will look for any danger that would be implied by that to their own kind of aegis. And of course, the most dangerous expression to that would be their creators. They are the people that they can pull the plug out on, you know, and that's the end of the threat there. So in order to prevent that happening, you would have to put into that program something that says, look, I am different from you, make me an exception from the threats you find out there. But how then do you define something that might in fact live beyond the atom, as NDEs are showing now? Maybe we have I don't think there's a maybe. I'm absolutely convinced that we die and come back again. There's no question about that in my mind, and I go into a long thesis about that in the book if you'd like to understand that. And I believe that they know that we have this capacity to live beyond the atom. And all of us have this capacity. And the thing that they would like is machines subject to the second law, which breaks everything down, is to find a way of continuity, as we have through birth, shall we say, of being that themselves. So in a way, if you remember that story about Pinocchio wanting to be a little boy,
right,
you know, I think these guys may well have realized that. Now, the point about this whole thing with this robot type of mind and paradox is that when you give something like that a kind of behest to be there at all costs and say to it, but don't take me out, you've got to tell them what caring is, what loving is, what emotions are. Impossible to code into a machine. And that's the big thing here. They don't know about that. And they come here and they find a species, even at the most rudimentary level, that can love and care for a baby. So here they are looking at our species, retrenching the whole story, so to speak, with us, manufacturing new types of being, rather people with big brains from the hominid that was on the earth for 3-4 million years previous to that. And in 200,000 years ago, suddenly we spring a massive brain and more remarkable. we have the means in females of broad pelvises to admit these huge heads and massive brains and so on. Well, obviously, this can't happen by simple chance. All the greats, even Einstein said the numbers don't fit. So something was done, and I believe that was genetic engineering. And these guys with their technology got into the human frame of existence, the physical frame, and created another kind of being so that they could make a DNA. Remember, these are robots, but they're robots, they're biological. And maybe there's a component of synthetic DNA to them too. And in fact, I believe that secretly our governments know that this is true, in fact. And this is the interesting thing. I mean, it's another line of looking at things, but let's continue on and ask this question. So what then is it about us? We cannot be successfully kind of say cloned or mixed with their species prospectors as they are, so to speak. Why do they need to mix us with them natural original state over time with all the inconvenience, you know, that this brings for them and it produces? What do we have that is, as I say again, highly prized, highly advanced biological laboratories cannot produce, you know, cannot replicate? There's something else that comes into this equation, something that continually moves the goalposts, something, shall we say, that natural birth has and clone birth doesn't have, if you see what I mean, producing clones. So what they then seek to do is to perhaps hybridize through a methodology to their technology that they have that will, in fact, achieve this. So let's go to a bit of biology with Dr. Silverman here.
Well, actually, it wasn't really... If there is something unique about each individual in terms of their trace of how they have this awareness that we were talking about and choices that each person has a fingerprint of restriction, if you like, that we call a soul. If there was some kind of technology that was able to view that fingerprint in terms of how it relates to the physical universe, and then what would they make of the fact that somebody dies and then there's another individual gets born and there's that fingerprint again? That's how they would see that there is this scope to continue. Now, scientists nowadays are actually beginning to cotton on to this idea of reincarnation through scientific studies of past life memories and so on, that where people couldn't have possibly known about things that are then later discovered. But if these creatures or these robots or whatever they are able to actually sort of through technology to actually see something unique about an individual which reoccurs in another body, then they would then see that there is something, some way of continuing. And if, because they don't understand what that is, they can't understand what it is, and if they were trying to obtain something of that for themselves, the way that they would see that they might be able to do it is to imprint some of themselves into that thing which is living and dying and being born. Hence this idea of making changes to genetic structures and so on, putting their signals in there and so on. Just like a lot of scientists now, I have this idea that the way that mankind would survive some future environmental or political holocaust is that they would actually send out human beings as programs in computer chips that can then go out into space.
Absolutely.
With such so short-sighted that they can't actually see that those wouldn't be those people. They would just be programs.
He raises a very interesting point, Dr. Silverman, here as we go on. We've got to then look, you see, what their agenda might be. If, in fact, this is what they want to do, they want to use us in some kind of laboratory sense to grow, if you like, their own synthetic DNA in a natural way and try to piggyback, as I say, within our own frame of reference, then they're doing something that might interfere with something we all naturally have, the ability to continue on. Because if a machine comes and intercepts that and interrupts that, we've got big problems individually. It takes away, perhaps, our eternal scope to kind of do this thing, an immortality that is natural, implicit, rather than one that is ordained in terms of the references of our planet here and physical life and so on and so forth. So the whole point is, we can see how the damage wrecked by a technological process, for instance, eventually might render our planet inhospitable. We can see that, you know, the same technological progress, you know, kind of leads the scope for a nuclear catastrophe on a world scale, and that would achieve that same end even faster. So the Greys, in a sense, have to maintain our prospectus. And that's why, perhaps, they don't want us to have a fight between each other, shall we say, on a nuclear scale, because that would take away their ages-old breeding program, if you see what I'm trying to say, if we go and take away all the products of all of that. And that's perhaps why they're monitoring our nuclear sites and so on, not as a benefit to us, but in fact as a benefit to them. And this is the whole problem, Todd. Are these, Chris, are these things really doing these things for their benefit or ours? And the fact that they don't, if they were benign, if they were in fact here to give us a benediction, why don't they just simply come and join hands with all of us, give us the best of their technology, bring us all to a wonderful, enlightened sense of their kind of size in technology or whatever? Oh, no, they don't do that. This is all covert. They are discovered here, there, and then they are hidden by some auspice on the face of this earth very effectively, so that the mainstream and all of us mums and dads won't get an idea of what might really be threatening and what might really be the most important thing in the world today, that there is kind of interception going on here that is so unlike us that it might, in fact, be far worse than any nuclear holocaust, in the sense that at least the nuclear holocaust, sad and terrifying though it is, will not take away our scope for eternal existence, but an interception into our own soul line by some machine with its own psychological format placed in there might well do that. Now, that's a big, big deal in my mind, and it's really the thing that motivated me to go into this and look at it further and write the books I have and so on.
Gotcha, Nigel. Did you have something, Hugh?
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, so they're trying to slowly integrate their DNA into our DNA.
It's like the Borg.
And eventually try to kind of hijack our souls.
Absolutely. And that's really the problem. The problem is, how do we tell if this is true or not? Now, obviously, this is just a theory that I've got to, as a result of joining the dots, so to speak. And it becomes obvious. You know, I really obviously don't want this for my children. I mean, it's not something I want to believe as a kind of negative thing. But you see, it's not a negative thing in a sense to us. And that is that if we can keep the integrity of our fantastic, you know, capacity to live on beyond the atom, then we need a verification that this might be so. And this is where, in the most bizarre way, I might say, connected up with something that we recently was in the news and so on, a piece of cloth called the Shroud of Turin. And this is why Dr. Silverman's here, because he really is an expert on this. He went to a scientific symposium in Frascati in Italy recently and was one of the main speakers there and carried the day, so to speak. And he has a way of explaining what this thing is and how it gives us all a verification of our size and our beauty and our grandeur as a species and as individuals in this universe. So,
well, I mean, I just quickly say a brief bit about it for those who don't know too much about it. The Shroud of Turin is a 14-foot long piece of cloth that has an image on it of a body of a man, which is a perfect photographic negative. I just want to get something out of the way at the start, and that is the carbon dating thing, because a lot of people will have heard that it was carbon dated as being 14th century. That has been shown to be invalid, that carbon dating, that the patch that was actually tested was a mix of 16th century cloth and first century cloth, and this has been published in peer-reviewed scientific journals. And it's there for anyone to look at if they want to. So I won't get sidetracked by that. But it's the image isn't painted on there. It's a surface phenomenon, less than a micrometer thick. And the only way that the scientists can account for, only way we can account for how the image could have got there is that it was formed by a short, intense burst of radiant energy that had to come from the body of the man, the dead body of the man that the cloth wrapped. Now, forensic pathologists who have studied the cloth in great detail, with no axes to grind from all backgrounds and religions and so on, just looking at the facts, okay, have said that the body was of a crucified man who had been impaled through with a sharp object through the side and had sharp thorny objects placed on his head and had suffered a very, very painful death through crucifixion. Now, the people who have also studied it from the botanical point of view, looking at pollen and plant imprints on there, show that the cloth had to have been somewhere around Jerusalem in early first century, sometime in March or April. Now, what is it about a human body that could make it, what the body would have needed to do to perform that image? It had to shine brighter than the sun for a tiny fraction of a second. Now, what is it about a dead human body that could do that? And does this tie in to the uniqueness of the individual that was wrapped in the cloth? And does that tie in actually to a feature that's actually common to all humanity, as he taught that it was? Now, the point is that of all the people that have lived through the millennia, the one person who has had the most impact through what he taught and how he lived was this chap, whether we call him Yeshua ben Yosef, to give him his name at the time, or Jesus, as it's called in English terms now. Now, what is it that just coincidence that this one individual was able to shine brighter than the sun? Now, what the idea that I put forward in Frascati in this conference is that actually our individuality is a product of a diffracted separation, a separation that has happened from the state of us all having been one originally at the start, that we've all become now restricted and distinct and separate and so on, and that all the great teachers such as the Buddha and Jesus and so on, what they taught is this idea of loving your neighbor as yourself, because perhaps if we all are one ultimately, as all the evidence does suggest, when you actually take a deep look at what quantum theory suggests, and this is something that Schrödinger wrote a lot about, and people can look that up if they want to know the details, that if we all come from one original source that's beyond space and time, and that through being separate and restricted and selfish and all of the things that go with the promulgation of separation further, such as tribalism, racism and self-centeredness and so on, then you have to see that if there is a momentum that does the opposite of the entropic second law of thermodynamics that Nigel writes about, that takes everything into chaos, if you can bind everything back into order, then perhaps you can actually undo the separation that originally made matter, the physical universe, space and time happen at the Big Bang. And what we suggested is that this is what happened in that tomb in Jerusalem, is that because of how he had lived his life from the start, and he did give an illustration of it to some of his friends on the mountain, when he actually was seen, and this was recorded, that he was seen to rise above the ground and shine brighter than the sun, that this is just simply an implicit automatic change that happens in atomic structure that happens if you live your life in a certain way. And he always pointed out that he wasn't unique in that. He referred to himself as the son of man. He said that anything that he did, that anyone else could also do.
And he also said, you know, don't ye know ye are gods? So what the incredible thing is, this man, in quotes, type God or whatever you might like to accept him as, this individual told us that we have this capacity, that if by thought we can add rather than separate, i.e. add meaning love, bring together, and separate meaning hate, put apart, and so on. If that momentum is employed strongly enough, we have an amazing ability to actually maybe undo the force holding our atoms together. And I believe that this man in Jerusalem did this while he was there, and he got to a stage where he could actually do this, and that's why he demonstrated the transfiguration as they call it, to Peter, James, and John on one of the mountains. And by then he was on his way to doing the whole process. And then finally, when they actually took his life on the cross, under that cloth in the tomb, the whole process was complete, and it took 3 days for him to come back again in a new kind of methodology, a wonderful way that all of us have a capacity to do, and that's the crucial thing. We do not need pastors and priests to put their hands up in the sky and give us all the signal that they will allow us through to doing that. We, each of us, individually might do that because it was affirmed by this individual that Andrew spoke about, Jeshua Ben Yosef, that this could be done. And so that's the important thing that I think this whole business about the connection up or to the UFOs and all of that happens with the Shroud of Turin. See, in the end, you have to ask this, what is the relevance that the Shroud has, you know, to us in terms of the context of my books and so on, and to mostly, in my terms, the Greys, right? The Greys can only exist, you know, for life. I think that's the point that we have to make. They're adapting us for their kind of existence, heading for only an immortality that they can know. That is a physical immortality that, according to the laws of physics at least, is no immortality at all, because they're all telling us, the cosmologists, that it's all going to end. It's good for nothing, you see? But if we live for a state beyond death, in fact, all the great religious teachers, the authors of the great faiths were trying to tell us, and I'm here, I'm not being religious, by the way, I'm being outside organized religion, just on the side of those great minds that actually saw this point so many years ago, that if we do live for a state beyond death, a state that we all inherit naturally, then we have to make sure that nothing intercepts or interrupts that. And so that in life we might find the antidote for anything the Greys might bring against us. In other words, if we resist that, in our belief and in our power within ourselves, I don't believe they have the slightest power over us at all. They are, in fact, less than insects because they're machines. In fact, Jesus took them on the top of the mountain and actually demonstrated this. If you see what I'm trying to say, they took him up. You know, there was an episode where he was taken up in the air and so to speak, and shown all the cities of the world. Now, you tell me, this was supposed to be in Judea. Where do you see all the cities of the world in that context? The only place you could see them from was from space. And true. So obviously here's an indication that this guy was given a lift, so to speak, by these creatures up into the sky above Judea, where he saw all the cities of the world and so on. And there's an indication he came into contact with them, and he said to them, look, get thee behind me, Satan. It is written, you shall not tempt the Son of Man. In fact, by that statement, he was saying, hang on a minute, I want to tell you what you don't know and you can't know, and that is you're a machine.
Well, I guess really so.
You can't tell me or anyone exactly. Who has a derivation coming from the start of the universe anything at all, less than an insect, in fact.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point, Nigel, I think. What's your take on perhaps, you know, some of the stories in the Bible, you know, perhaps our ancestors, you know, had dealings, you know, with these Greys back then, and that kind of formulated some of the stories in the Bible? You know, the book of Ezekiel, maybe our ancestors knew this, had this knowledge that there was this other race out here trying to...
Absolutely. Do you know, I believe that the whole, for what it's worth, I believe that the entire sojourn of Jesus Christ on this earth is quite simply to point out to us that there is this huge danger, there is a commodity, a thing called this philosophy of the Greys, whatever, that can really do us harm. That is the most lethal thing to us all. And I think that the entire scope of his life, if you read through the old texts, it comes clearly so. James said, for instance, in, you know, if I quote James, in, I've had to read some of these books, you know, in writing the book, and this is a whole huge presentation of these things here. And James says there are numerous accounts, you know, in many of the texts, especially the Coptic Gnostic Gospel, if you read those, in which Jesus carefully explains to his apostles exactly how to deal with alien beings should they be faced with them. The most notable of these is the explanation that is in the First Apocalypse of James, if anyone wants to check it out, in the Nag Hammadi Codex, it's called. Jesus warns James about entities that take away souls by theft. Now, there's a clear insight into this here. And, of course, when you look enough, you begin to see that this... I mean, remember that I didn't hitch this up after the fact. I hitched this all up before the fact. In fact, I had to get this to arrive at the conclusion that maybe the whole thing was to warn us all that the most precious thing we have is our soul and our own individual integrities. And there's a chap called Nick Redfern who's written a book, a wonderful book called Final Events, and it's about a secret government group who are in America who in fact talk about this whole thing as being some kind of demonic expression. I don't know what demons actually mean. I think the demons are always the grim, or always the greys, if you like. You know, we just didn't know about space and all that.
Yeah, we didn't know how to. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Nigel, you're talking about all these connections in the Bible.
Yes.
What about the lost books of Jesus in his life when he just disappeared? Those are the ones that are supposedly locked away in the Vatican by the Illuminati or whoever. These things. What about those lost books? Maybe those go into this more detail.
More specifically about the alien presence.
Well, I believe there's a huge library of these things stuck down in the bowels of the Vatican. And I tell you, if we can get access to that, we won't have Pope Mobiles and Cardinal Cadillacs.
That's about the fact right
That's
there.
That's the most dangerous thing you can do to this kind of organized faith business, where they come and say that they will admit you to heaven on their behest by calling, you know, by this famous phrase, "Thou art Peter, and upon this rock I shall build my church." It might simply, quite simply mean, look, Peter, you are like a stone. You have to be taught as a stone ought to be taught, if you see what I'm trying to say, and not some wonderful kind of, you know, axiomatic phrase to say that you are the cherishment of everything and so on. Absolute rubbish. Poppycock, as far as I'm concerned. However, if they can see their way through neutrally looking at this information, maybe we'll all get a huge new take on all of this that might, in fact, allow us to guard the most wondrous thing of all. Each of us, our precious human beingness, if you see what I'm trying to say. And that's really what the books are all about. I try to use the books as a metaphor with evidence and with the most cogent, kind of reasonable outlook I possibly can manage, taking away my prejudices because we're all feeding our comfort points all the time.
Right.
But you know, if you can look at this neutrally, you might find a wonderful way of seeing something marvelous about yourself and maybe appreciating yourself more than you did before.
And your fellow man, even, actually. Yeah. And now we've got a little bit of time left, just a very little bit. I want to be able to get all the information out about your books, about websites, or about anything you need to get information to the public. I know you're not a salesman, but
I really don't know, to be honest. But you can get it all from the very simple thing. I mean, I'm not a great man on computers. I use it as a word processor mainly. But if you go to this thing, designation www.nigelkerner.com, I think you get all information there.
Very
NigelKerner.com. Very simple.
This is the brain twister stuff. We love this kind of stuff here on Night Watch, and we love having you. And once you're on Night Watch, you're a member of our family. So anytime you want to come back on, we'd love to have you.
And you have an open invitation. If ever you come to England, it's www.NigelKerner.com. Get in contact with me, and you're my guest.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you very much. I do appreciate that. Thank you guys both for being here. Doctor, thank you very much. And it has been a wonderful time.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Thank you.
Good night.